Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
Well, today's program, we have quite a panoply of things to discuss, a lot of new science, a few new drugs, interesting stuff about bugs, and using bugs as drugs. That and also answers to your questions. Let's start with the big news of February 24th, and that is the FDA review that was released today, showing that a single shot, a one-shot coronavirus vaccine made by Johnson & Johnson was found to be safe and effective, and it completely prevented hospitalizations and deaths in a large clinical trial. And of course, that's what we need. We need to tame this puppy. It's likely to be authorized as soon as this weekend. And I'll give you the stats in just a moment about it. That will get us ready very quickly, about 2 million doses. And then they're supposed to be able to ramp up to 20 million out there to be delivered by the end of the month of March. So we're making some progress. Now, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was 85% effective against preventing severe disease. And it also worked against severe COVID-19 in United States, South Africa, and Brazil variants. So that's very important because it shows that it's working against those regional variants that have emerged. So 85% at preventing severe disease, 100% effective at preventing hospitalizations, but only 42% effective in preventing moderate to severe illness in people over the age of 60 who also had medical risk factors. The lower efficacy in that subgroup analysis seemed to be driven by older adults with diabetes, but it's a very small number, and so you're going to find little flukes like this showing up. It would be important, I think, if you are a diabetic and get this vaccine, and I'm recommending this as well to the people that cross my way who have suppression that they know about. I'm recommending that you get an antibody titer at about a month after the vaccine and see if you've got a decent level of antibody against COVID-19. Those antibody titers run between $50 and $100. That might be an out-of-pocket expense for you. I have no idea. I'd predict medical outcomes. I do not predict insurance outcomes because that you might as well just flip a coin. Nevertheless, affordable for most people, particularly if it lets you know that you got a good take on that vaccine. I want to move to our first email because it's germane to this, and this came from Gloria in Santa Cruz. Subject, COVID vaccine for people with chemical sensitivities. Would you recommend waiting for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine for someone with long-standing and increasing reactions to silicone and other polymers, latex, spandex, polyesters, perfumes, etc.? Well, as many of you know, I have been volunteering at the Dignity Vaccine Clinic and both giving vaccines and also screening people. In fact, I posted on my Twitter feed, which is Ask Dr. Dawn, the @ Ask Dr. Dawn, the picture of me with one of my early vaccine clients. We were both very happy to be there, and you can practically see the thought balloons coming off of us. We are positively glowing, so happy to see something getting rolling. But I can understand, Gloria, why you might be a little concerned about that. So a couple of bits of advice. You say in your letter, in addition to skin and breathing reactions, these also set off herpes outbreaks. So one bit of decent advice is talk to your doctor about getting a prescription for acyclovir, or better yet, valacyclovir, which is a little easier to take, and pre-medicate yourself for that. Whenever I'm doing any kind of surgery or injection around the mouth in someone who has a history of herpes, I'll have them pre-medicate with Valtrex. It's very helpful, and just a couple of doses within the 24 hours before you have it, you'll have a blood circulating level of something that inhibits the reproduction of that herpes virus and will allow your system to avoid an outbreak. Unfortunately, in your letter, you don't tell me whether you had vaccine reactions to things like flu or tetanus. And that's probably the most important indicator of whether or not you have any substantial risk of a bad reaction to the things you've listed. Many of these things give off volatile organic compounds, so it's probably a direct irritant reaction in your lungs, and it's unlikely to cross-react with anything in the vaccine. Latex, for example, is not present in vaccines. That would be a very bad idea given the number of latex-sensitive people. We don't use latex gloves. There's no latex in the vaccine center, so you're safe there. Nothing that you list is actually used in vaccines. However, if you go to the FDA website or just Google the Johnson & Johnson EUA letter, you'll find a list of all of the inert agents, all of the adjuvants, any preservatives, all that are in there. And that'll give you a chance to at least look down the list and see if there's anything that rings a bell as having given you a previous reaction. I very seriously doubt it. I don't know how old you are, but if you've had a colonoscopy, you've been exposed to one of the components in the vaccine when the prep, or if you've ever had a bowel prep for any reason, that compound is in the vaccine in a very low, low level. It's not going to give you diarrhea when you inject it into a muscle. The other compound is a very widely used food additive. You'll find it in whipped cream and ice cream. So if you can eat whipped cream or ice cream without having a reaction, you're probably good. Now, I wanted to take a moment and just give you a little functional medicine perspective on what I'm hearing. First of all, your immune system is getting a signal, and particularly because you get wheezing, your immune system is giving you a signal that it is on high vigilance. And it would be a really good idea to get your gut checked out by a functional medicine doctor, because the head and shoulders above all the rest, the most common cause for this sort of manifestation is bad bacteria. And these bacteria are sending an alarm response. If a person takes a lot of aspirin or ibuprofen, that can contribute in an indirect way because little bits of broken down dead bacteria actually leak across the bowel wall. There's a lot here that can probably be done to reverse the reactions you're having and make life a little bit easier and a little bit safer for you. So I hope that you will go to the Institute for Functional Medicine and pop in your zip code and consider working with one of the certified practitioners. Actually, ironically, this week I am grading board exams for the Institute for Functional Medicine. They do a board exam. One of the components is to have to actually do some functional medicine. And I have been getting a lovely refresher course on my processes as I read through other people's work. So let's move on. Promised you new drugs. Let's move on. This game changer drug for treating obesity may become the new standard of care. This came out of London, but there are similar drugs that are approved in the United States. And in this case, about 35% of people who took this new drug for treating obesity, because they've basically reframed it from being a diabetic drug to an obesity drug, they lost more than one-fifth of their total body weight, according to a major study. That was really, really amazing. This was published in the New England Journal of Medicine last week. The drug is called semaglutide, S-E-M-A-G-L-U-T-I-D-E. And listen for that glutide ending. You'll see drugs being advertised on TV. These are given by injection. They are FDA approved for the treatment of diabetes and are showing great promise in research in derailing pre-diabetes, primarily by affecting people's appetite. In the study, 75% of the people who were treated lost more than 10% of their body weight. These were all overweight people. And this is a very, very big weight loss. While we're talking about a weight loss of that kind, you want to avoid rapid weight losses if you have a history of a lot of fillings. You'll want to moderate the rate of that weight loss or do a lot of wheatgrass shakes, because the body fat stores mercury. And when you lose weight, particularly fat, rapidly, which is what happened in this group, they lost almost exclusively fat, the results were excellent. Now, this is used to treat diabetes, I said. It is a drug that works with GLP-1. It's really good to see it translating into treatment for people with obesity. This was, a randomized clinical trial, 1,900 adults. It's given weekly, once a week, subcutaneously. People self-inject. The study ran for 68 weeks, and that was during that time that people lost an average of 30 pounds, quite a little over 30 pounds, actually, quite substantial. Meanwhile, the placebo group, who was also injecting, lost about 5 pounds. So really, really not a substantial difference. The drug mimics this human glucagon-like peptide, which is normally released into the bloodstream when you have finished a meal. It reduces hunger. It causes delayed gastric emptying. So that's why it's so helpful with diabetics, because they don't absorb their glucose as quickly, so that prevents those insulin spikes that lead to the insulin resistance that get us into this whole mess in the first place. So I'm looking forward to maybe using some of the agents that are available to me in the United States off-label. Of course, this is England. It's the National Health. They have an actual closed system that makes sense. So I'm sure that given the cost of managing the health complications of obesity, giving people a drug for a year that is expensive would pay for itself. Here in the United States, this drug or its cousins are expensive, and we're talking like $700 a month, which you can bet you're going to get some serious pushback from your insurance company on that one. Here we have a broken system. The payer, and I'm going to editorialize just a tiny bit, the payer and the buyer is not the person who needs the drug. The buyer is their insurance company. There's no market pressure to speak of to cause competition to lower the price to the insurance company, which doesn't want to pay for it in the first place. If the consumer was paying for it, believe me, there's competition for price. And you'll see that a lot in any agent that is directly marketed to consumers. The other thing that would work would be if there was a national drug formulary of things that the government said, these are on the formulary. If the person meets the criteria, you have to pay for it. No arguments. No, oh, it's not on our formulary. And a national formulary would have the two or three really important goals. It would cut out a lot of the, pardon the expression, it would cut out a lot of the fat in our system. It would close the loop so that we could have an actual market. There is a totally broken market, if you want to worship the market, in the way we manage healthcare, particularly pharmaceuticals in this country. And it needs to change in a fundamental way. I don't know what that's going to look like, and I don't think we'll get that anytime soon, but just saying. What about superior resistance to cold? You know, you've probably heard about cold therapy. This comes out of the Karolinska Institute. Almost 1 in 5 people in Sweden lack the protein alpha-actinin in their muscle fiber. Researchers in Sweden show that the more the skeletal muscle of these individuals comprises slow-twitch muscle fibers, which are more durable and energy efficient and provide better tolerance to low temperatures, the more you have, the better off you are in handling cold. Skeletal muscle has fast-twitch fibers, which are white, they fatigue quickly, and slow-twitch fibers, which are more resistant to fatigue. The protein, alpha-actinin 3, is found only in the fast-twitch fibers, which is actually absent in about 1 in 5 people. That's in the planet, you know, 1.5 billion individuals. They have a mutation in the genes. In evolutionary terms, when humans migrated from Africa to the colder climates, there were a couple of important gene mutations that actually promoted survival. One of them that you may have heard about is the lactase gene. So normally, as you get older, lactase, an enzyme that digests milk, turns off. You methylate the gene and you stop making it. In a mutation which occurred as humans migrated north and began herding, you now have lactase mutation so that it stays turned on. And interestingly enough, this particular mutation happened twice. Once, as I said, in the Nordic peoples, and a second time in a different location about 10,000 years ago in Africa. And you probably have heard of the tribe, the Maasai, who have large cow herds, herds of cows, and that is to say. And they drink a combination of milk and blood as part of their traditional diet. And they turned off the gene for lactose intolerance. They turned off the gene that turns off lactase a long time ago, around the time that they started keeping cows. It was a big survival advantage for them because it increased their food supply. But the other thing is that people who lack the actinin 3 are better at keeping warm, and they can endure a tougher and colder climate. So they studied this. They took, is what I'm going to say before I read you this method. They took 42 healthy men between the ages of 18 and 40, and they asked them to sit in 14 degrees centigrade water until their body temperature had dropped to 35.5 centigrade. So normal temperature is about 36.5 to 37. So during cold water immersion, they measured electrical activity of the muscles, and they took muscle biopsies to study the protein and the fiber type concentration. So what they found was that people who lacked the actinin 3 gene had, of course, a large proportion of slow twitch fibers. These individuals were able to maintain their body temperature in a more energy efficient way. Rather than activating the fast twitch fibers, which results in shivering, they increased the slow twitch fibers and basically just tensed up all their muscles. This gave them an evolutionary advantage during the migration to the colder climate, but now this may be an advantage because it interferes with certain kinds of sports activity. People who lack this gene rarely succeed in sports requiring strength and explosiveness, but they do have the ability to do endurance sports. So this got me thinking about cold water therapy, because I had heard quite a bit about cold water therapy and weight loss. And so I did a little searching, and we're now going to talk about the New Year's Day in Chicago, where there are a number of crazy, possibly crazy people who plunge into Lake Michigan. And if it's frozen over, they lie on the ice and make snow angels in their bathing suits. Polar bear clubs are all over the place. These groups of people advocate cold water therapy, and they say it's good for them. We've been studying how that might work for a long time. So let's start with human babies. Human babies have a large surface to volume ratio. That means that they can lose heat very quickly, and they can't shiver very well. So babies need a different way to raise their body temperature, and babies have a lot of something called brown fat. They also have a lot of bone marrow because they have to keep building more and more blood. And just like the bone marrow, as you mature, the proportion of bone marrow or brown fat in your body drops. But the brown fat burns stored energy and creates heat without shivering. And guess where the brown fat gets its fuel? It gets it from the human body in the form of white fat. So brown fat burns white fat. A period of cold temperature causes your brown fat to become more active. And in one study, they did a 3-hour period of cold exposure and burned 250 extra calories by using brown fat. Now, we're on a different subject here than the fast twitch and slow twitch. So this is a different adaptation and one that is pretty universal in babies. But brown fat was thought a while ago to totally disappear from adults. Turns out that's not true. Normal weight adults have deposits of brown fat around their shoulders and their spinal cord, with women having a bit more than men. And there's quite a lot of individual variation. Would be lovely to find an agent that caused your white fat to convert into brown fat. And by the way, the reason brown fat is brown is because it has the adipocytes, the fat cells, are full of mitochondria, which are burning those two carbon fragments. It's literally crowded with mitochondria, and that's what gives brown fat its color. You know who doesn't have brown fat? Most people who are obese. In fact, if you're lucky enough to be born with a higher amount of brown fat, you'll be one of those people that the rest of us love to hate, who have a really hard time gaining weight. And what we've now learned is that cold exposure, especially to the shoulders and the spine, actually stimulates the growth of brown fat deposits. So you think about it. Cold temperature lets your body know that it's worth maintaining this calorically demanding fat as a survival trait. So could we induce that? And for a while, there was this huge industry of spa devices. When I searched this, the first thing that came up were ads for something called Cool Sculpt, which is supposed to get rid of white fat by freezing it and increase brown fat. Could not find a scrap of research that validated that in a Google Scholar search. So we're just going to take that one and put it in our back pocket. If you spent the day in a low temperature environment, you would burn more calories, but you'd be uncomfortable. It turns out that brown fat and cold exposure do something else really important. They heal the hormonal dysfunctions that accompany obesity. And this is the reason I'm telling you about this. Obese people become resistant to a hormone called leptin. Leptin is one of the most important regulators of body mass. It's the kind of thermostat that works very hard to keep your body mass constant. So when your fat stores are low and declining, it'll increase your appetite. When your fat stores are high, it'll decrease your appetite. And so it keeps you at your weight set point. This is called the adipostat hypothesis. Thermostat, adipostat is basically your fat stat. So the problem is that as obese people become leptin resistant, any attempt to cut calories or burn calories through exercise causes their body to respond with an all-out defense of the fat. Think of it like this. If you have the air conditioning on and you have the windows open, the thermostat is going to keep cranking up the air conditioner harder and harder to try to keep your house cold. If that is broken, in other words, you'll increase the appetite if you're losing weight. If you're gaining weight, it'll reduce your appetite. If that's broken, that's how people can get to this very, very high weight. In fact, fat people produce 5 or 6 times more leptin than a thin person, but their body can't hear the signal. So here's where the cold comes in. Cold exposure improves leptin sensitivity. So the body can start hearing the signal and go to a lower set point. So cold therapy, if we can figure out how to do it, would potentially make a very, very big difference. Now, please don't go climb into the freezer truck, because you can get hypothermia that way, and that can be a life-threatening condition. So it's extremely important that this be done in a science-derived way. But you know what? You might actually improve your immune system. It turns out that swimming in cold water will actually improve the functioning of the immune system against respiratory viruses. It also increases the level of your endogenous antioxidants, the ones that are really, really effective. So it turns down inflammation and it gets your body kind of in condition to deal with environmental stressors like viral infections or cold. So, aren't these interconnections fascinating? And we are learning so much. Very excited about this. We're going now to an email from Marla in Illinois. It sort of dovetails nicely with the discussion we've been having so far. Marla writes, breaking fast and supplements. You were so kind to respond to an earlier question I had about supplementing and fasting. Though I don't think I asked the right question, so I'll rephrase it. After a 16-hour fast, or however long, once you break it with food, is it okay then to take supplements? Does the body know the difference between what it gets from a supplement versus food? I take a host of supplements. Some are vitamins, minerals. I use a powdered marine collagen. I don't want to skip these because I practice intermittent fasting. Well, the concern with supplements is if you're taking antioxidants during the time that you're fasting, you won't get the oxidative stress, so you won't get necessarily the benefit, the full benefit of the fasting, which does seem to require a little oxidative stress. However, that's a short-lived effect under most circumstances. Animals feed, you know, in the nature, you would feed once, perhaps twice a day. In our modern world, people eat, on the average American eats something every 2 to 3 hours, except while asleep. So when you are basically doing a 16-hour fast, you're really setting yourself up for some improved health. This is also showing some benefit in diabetes, but of course, insulin-dependent diabetics can't do this technique. As far as the difference between foods and supplements, this hasn't really been well studied. But in general, foodstuffs vary widely in their chemical content anyway, depending upon what kind of fertilizer and what kind of soil and the climate conditions that they were grown in. Foods all seem to play well together, unless they're unhealthy foods to start with. So I think that we can say that it's okay to combine all of the supplements and also to combine supplements with food. And that might, in fact, be the best way to do it. So I hope that's helpful. And I think it's fine for you to add those supplements in when you break your fast and start eating. And depending upon which supplements we're talking about, minerals, it's probably better to spread out the dose throughout the day if you're taking something like magnesium or calcium, because you'll get better absorption. But you just stay within that eating period and break the dose into two, and you should be good. We're going to move on to our next story now. As promised, it's time to talk about bugs. Stress has long been thought to trigger heart attacks, but the mechanism is unknown. Now, researchers think that bacteria could play a role. This study was published in MBio. It shows that stress hormones can break up mats of bacteria growing on the plaques and arteries, releasing the plaques and causing strokes or heart attacks. Now, for years, we've known that when a person has a heart attack, when you look at the plaque, you'll find bacteria, often things like chlamydia or some of the pathogenic gut bacteria, but we haven't really understood what the implications were. But it turns out, as regular listeners will know, that bacteria love to form colony groups. Let's call them little bacterial coral reefs, widely populated with a bunch of bacteria, and you get coral and you get algae and you get other things that are all happily growing together and creating an environment that can persist. So the plaques form on any rough surface. The blood vessels, when they're healthy, are very smooth. So there's not a bend in the river for the bacteria to grab onto, but that's exactly what plaque starts to do. The bacteria attach to the plaque, and then they grow in a biofilm held together by a sort of scaffolding, and there's your coral reef. So looking at the arteries from 15 people with cardiovascular disease, a team led by bacteriologist David Davies of Binghamton University in New York analyzed those arteries. Using fluorescent tags that mark bacterial DNA, they discovered at least 10 species of bacteria clustered tightly around the plaques, including one of our least favorite bugs in the hospital, a bug called Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which is a champion biofilm former and loves to hide in a biofilm shell. It contaminates respiratory equipment. It contaminates the pipes that carry oxygen in the walls. It's a very serious issue and hard to control. The biofilms are tightly attached to the plaques. They may actually be stabilizing it, keeping the plaques from breaking apart, because that's how heart attacks happen. The plaques are normally stable, but they'll break up and either enter the bloodstream and move downstream where the artery is narrower. And they can also actually, in some individuals, move, if they're in their neck, for example, they can break up and move to your brain and cause a stroke. The plaques also, when they start to chip off, or like paint chipping off a wall, they create a place that the platelets want to jump onto. And so if you crack a plaque in your heart, the platelets jump onto it and rapidly plug the area. We call that a heart attack. So these researchers grew Pseudomonas aeruginosa in artificial arteries made of silicone and waited for the biofilms to form. And then they flooded the tubes with the human stress hormone, norepinephrine or noradrenaline. We all know what adrenaline is, right? It caused the biofilms to break up. What happened was that the stress hormone, adrenaline, triggered the body cells in the blood vessels to release iron. The iron is toxic to the bacteria, and it causes them to produce enzymes that sever, that's like, let's get out of here. So they cut the mooring. They break up the polymer bonds that hold the biofilm together, kind of like, oh, I don't know, I'm sort of visualizing kicking a hornet's nest and all the bacteria just kind of swarming out, trying to get away from the attack. The plaque gets broken up in this case by those enzymes. And now we have a real interesting surprise. We're growing bacteria inside our blood vessels in cardiovascular disease. Now, I was taught that bacteria in the bloodstream would cause sepsis, a life-threatening, overwhelming response of the immune system. Say it isn't so, Batman. This is Pseudomonas, and it's growing in the arteries. Why is it not causing that response? Well, because it's hiding in the biofilm, and so the immune system isn't seeing it. This is, oddly enough, very similar to what tuberculosis does. It hides inside the lung for decades, and the immune system is just waiting out there for it, so it doesn't come out. Then when you are immunosuppressed, you're on your cancer chemotherapy. Wow, suddenly we get the recurrent TB. We see it all the time also in people with immune suppression like HIV patients. It's everything. Everything has a biofilm. Everything has bacteria. Everything has a microbiome. And what's growing in your microbiome can make a huge difference in your health outcome. Our next story talks about bacteria causing cancer. Now, we all have E. coli in our gut. It's one of the primary founding types of bacteria. But some strains of E. coli produce a genotoxin. It's called colibactin, and it's implicated in the development of colorectal cancer. Colibactin leaves a very specific change in the DNA of host cells. And this can be detected in, we can see it, we find this change, this DNA fingerprint in colorectal cancer cells. It takes a long time for these cancer cells to develop. And we've never really understood what makes a cancer cell become cancerous. But this group of researchers at the Max Planck Institute for Infection Biology have been able to analyze this and figure out what's going on with colibactin. It's inducing genetic changes that we know to be characteristic of cancer colorectal cells, and it's causing a transformed phenotype even after just a few hours of infection, because our colon cells grow so fast. About 2/3 of colorectal cancer patients can have this colibactin-producing strains or one of them in their gut, and the number is rising in the Western world. It was very difficult to prove direct proof, but this group has done exactly that. They've identified the genetic signature that's left in the host cells, and it can be detected. They did this by using organoids to observe the transformation itself. This is a new technology we've talked about before. It makes it possible to grow normal organs. They're not shaped and they aren't as functional, but the cells work. And these organoids can be used as a sort of living, I'd call them a pseudo-entity, really, to test cancer therapies and cancer mechanisms, as well as a host of drugs. Primary colon epithelial cells in the form of 3D spheres, that's what these organoids are. They're generated by the adult stem cells that are what drive the rapid turnover. You put those stem cells into a medium and they just grow into balls, kind of like early embryos, really. That's about all stem cells can do without instructions from their environment, is grow into hollow balls. Well, we can make use of that because we can study the cancer development. The team infected their organoids with colibactin-producing E. coli. Within 3 hours, this was already sufficient to induce the changes that are characteristic of colorectal. Not only did the cells begin to proliferate faster than normal, but this is the key. A subset of cells no longer require the presence of the WNT protein in the growth medium. This is critical because this growth factor is normally what you add in to the medium that you're growing these stem cells on. Now, in the body, it's a little different. If you take these organoids out of the culture medium that has the WNT in it, they turn into cancer. Now, ordinarily, we have in the structure of our colon, we have these pits, and the stem cells are at the bottom of the pits, and then we have these villi sticking up so that your gut looks like shag carpeting when it's healthy, but it's not just highs, there's also lows. And down at the base of those pits, that's where the stem cells live, that's where the other cells make WNT. So this growth factor is only present in the base. As the cells grow, they move upwards. They climb out of the pit. As they climb out of the pit and the level of WNT drops, they start to undergo the maturation process. And we see this with any kind of epithelial surface. They get more and more like the surface cells. And when they get up to the top, they're capable of releasing enzymes and disaccharidases and absorbing food and nutrients. What would make this fail? Well, if you make a stem cell that it doesn't need WNT anymore, instead, as it continues to grow up to the surface, it just keeps growing. It just keeps growing rapidly, and it turns into a polyp, and then the polyp turns into a cancer. We also saw to inherit this mutation with WNT signaling and still get colon cancer, they inherit mutations in P53 signaling. P53 is the mechanism that causes cells that are not working properly and are detected by proofreaders to be killed. What feeds or produces an environment that's favorable for the colibactin-producing cells? Inflammation. So there's your inflammatory diet. There's your fast food diet. There's your high sugar, low nutrient diet. In something like colitis or Crohn's disease, people have a more inflamed gut. They are particularly likely to have a dominant population of colibactin-producing E. coli strains. We think that we have found one of the major sources here, but it's just a piece of the puzzle. As there are outlying cancers, we think that part of this, at this point they're postulating, that the inflammation causes cell damage, the cell damage requires cellular repair, which requires the release of growth factors, and trying to heal the gut quickly on a tight time schedule, that's where the P53 comes in, because you don't slow down enough to catch the errors. If you've ever been working under deadline, and you go back and proofread the next morning and you're like, oh my God, what's going on here? That's essentially what's happening in the DNA. So what about fighting bacteria with bacteria? A new study coming out of the University of California of San Diego, researchers identified a universal strain of bacteria derived from healthy human skin that can treat the most common form of eczema, that's known as atopic dermatitis, our earlier email at the top of the hour, Gloria basically is a person suffering from atopic dermatitis. So this paper just published a couple of days ago in Nature Medicine was the first in-human phase 1 double-blind placebo-controlled trial looking to treat people living with eczema. And it worked. Two-thirds of the 54 participants reported improvement in their symptoms. How'd they find it and what's in it? Another bacteria, another form of Staphylococcus that is hugely anti-inflammatory because it gets rid of a different form of Staphylococcus. So the researchers looked at more than 8,000 isolates of staphylococcal bacteria coming from the skin of individuals without eczema. And they found a few strains that inhibited the growth of Staph aureus. This is a pathogenic bacteria. That's the one that causes staph infections. That's the bacteria that, when it becomes drug resistant, it's MRSA. And it's known to aggravate eczema, and it's known to be more common in the skin of people with eczema. Again, the bad bacteria like inflammation. That's their home turf. So they did a lot of screening. They looked at these strains and they were trying to weed through them. It had to have decreased capacity to damage skin, so it couldn't infect skin if you had a cut, and it had to be sensitive to antibiotics. And they ended up with one single strain of Staphylococcus hominis called A9 that could be used to treat atopic dermatitis. And the first tests were done in animal models where mice were given an experimental version of eczema, and then given this Staphylococcal hominis in a lotion, and it worked great. Cleaned up the fake eczema in only 3 days. So in this study, people showed a very good response. Now we need to figure out if you can use it for a long period of time. We need to figure out whether the Staph aureus that you don't want will become resistant to the Staph aureus. But this could be a real game changer for the 18 million people in the U.S. with atopic dermatitis. I'm also wondering if you could home grow this stuff in the right medium, but you'd probably get a mixed culture. So folks, don't try this one at home. So we've talked about bacteria in cancer, bacteria in heart attacks, and bacteria in eczema. Let's talk about phages. Even bugs have bugs. Virology, in case you hadn't noticed, has gotten a big boost in 2020. Lots of funding. And so we're having a bloom of research about a class of virus you may not know about. Bacteriophages. These are viruses that don't attack mammalian cells at all. They're viruses that perpetuate their species by infecting bacteria and causing the bacteria cells to rupture, releasing millions of virus cells. So this paper came out last week in the journal Cell, and it contains an analysis of over 28,000 gut microbiome samples collected in different parts of the world. They collected them by going into the sewer treatment plants because, you know what? If you want a sample of the gut, this is a good way to do it. I think we covered this story back in the spring, but there were people who were tracking COVID outbreaks and new clusters by looking at poop from the feeds that go into the sewage treatment plants, and that because those are mapped, it allowed them to identify neighborhoods where there was more COVID because they could test the sewage. So they used a DNA sequencing method called metagenomics, and they cataloged these viral species living in, well, basically 28,000 different human gut metagenomes. They also had a bunch of bacterial isolates from the human gut, and they found 140,000 viral species living in the human gut. Get this, folks, more than half of these had never been identified before. Most of these viruses are using DNA as their genetic material, which is different than the SARS-CoV or the Zika, which are RNA viruses. These samples came mainly from people who don't have any disease, and that's why they cross-checked it in isolates from control guts so that And they essentially were finding them in the isolated specimens that didn't come out of the sewage line. That tells us that this is not a sign of disease. And maybe it's a sign of health, because you can use bacteria to kill bacteria, but you can also use weaponized phages. And that's what our next story is about. Using viruses instead of antibiotics to tame troublesome drug-resistant bacteria is very promising. This was the National Institute of Health, and this is a study in mice where they used the phages to kill a multi-drug-resistant bacteria called Klebsiella pneumoniae. Klebsiella is found in gut flora. I see it quite a bit in people with irritable bowel syndrome. And it's considered a normal inhabitant at low levels, even by us functional medicine types. But if we see a lot of it, we're concerned. It is on the CDC list, strain ST258. It's on the list of the most wanted. It has the biggest antibiotic resistant. It's one of the biggest threats in the United States, and it is coming for us. There are very few treatment options for this. It's emerged against even these very, very new drugs. It's quite adaptive. So it's important to find a different way, something that perhaps these bacteria will have less of a chance against. This was a pilot study. They injected mice with phages. The phages were found from raw sewage, again, that they screened for viruses that would infect ST258. These are, of course, naturally occurring agents, and they go where the food is, right? Like Lily Sutton. They gave the mice Klebsiella, and then they injected them with the phages, and all of the phages worked. The mice that were treated earliest did the best. Mice treated 1 hour after infection showed a rapid recovery, those followed by those treated 8 hours, and even those at 24 hours didn't die. Control mice who were given salt water quickly developed severe sepsis and died. And they went and checked in the phage-treated mice to see if they could find any ST258 bacteria, and there were always less at any point during the treatment method, so this validates that it was actually interfering with the bacteria. But in the recovered mice, those bacteria were a little resistant to the phages that were used. So I think what we'll have to do is what we're finding with any kind of adaptive organism. You've got to hit it from three or four different directions at once. Take out its energy supply, take out its water, take out its armor, and then it just can't adapt fast enough in that many different directions. I see this as an extraordinarily promising therapy, and I'm really excited to see what's going to happen. We've come to the end. We have time for one very quick email, and then we'll be signing off for this week. This one comes from Reese in Boulder Creek. Reese writes, "What are the latest findings on dementia? Can it be controlled with medication? If so, what is the best one to use? How long does it take to go from just starting to really severe?" And the answer, unfortunately, Reese, is it's all over the map. There's wide variation, huge, amongst individuals with any particular type of disease. And some are very slow. There are many, many factors that influence it. There are multi-infarct dementia, which is caused by high blood pressure and small little losses of blood flow in the brain, which kills the brain cells. That one is control the blood pressure. Give a blood thinner. It's the best form of dementia to have because it's the most manageable. Lewy body dementia, which is the same protein, alpha-synuclein, that causes Parkinson's disease, but instead of coming from the movement part of the brain, it goes to the cognitive part of the brain first. And that particular form of dementia shows waxing and waning. So people can seem very lucid, and then they can seem very demented, and that's an important marker for that particular disease. But it is progressive, and I believe that where we will find our treatment there is in the microbiome, fixing the gut. We know that there's alpha-synuclein in the gut. We know that there are bacteria that produce a homonym, in other words, a similar molecule of alpha-synuclein that the immune system will recognize, so it cross-reacts. So effectively, the bacterial flora are immunizing us against our own brain. and then the immune system is obediently going up there and attacking that protein. We have got a lot of work to do, and I'm just going to close off by saying that a lot of this work depends on having a healthy microbiome.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.